Welcome to the Deep Dive, your shortcut to being well-informed. Today, we're looking at a career that's just incredibly versatile, almost surprisingly so.
Yeah, it really challenges your expectations.
We're diving into the sources on American rock drummer Hunt Sales.
And our mission really is to trace this journey. You've got a musician whose work touches some, well, truly pivotal moments in rock, different genres, different eras.
From prog to proto-punk, it's quite a range.
Exactly. We're looking at, you know, longevity, adaptability, and what makes a session player like him so valuable over decades, that foundational skill.
Okay, let's start with the fact that it always gets people. The aha moment. Hunt Sales.
Yeah.
Born 1954. He's the son of TV comedy legend Soupy Sales.
Right. It creates this... this fantastic contrast, doesn't it? You have this, like, icon of slapstick TV comedy.
Pies and Tates, yeah.
Exactly. And his son is laying down the beat for Iggy Pop and then later anchoring a band with David Bowie. It's fascinating.
It really is.
Yeah.
It tells you right away, this isn't going to be a standard career path.
Yeah.
The sources make it super clear that his professional life, almost from the start, was tied to his brother, Tony Sales, the bassist.
Mm-hmm. You almost never see one without the other in those early years.
That brotherly bond seems absolutely crucial. It's the bedrock.
Absolutely. Their first big thing together was Tony and the Tigers. And this wasn't, you know, some garage band nobody heard of. They got immediate exposure. Big time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, 1966, they were on Hullabaloo, which was national. And also Swingin' Time with Robin Seymour, a local Detroit show. Basically, teen idols learning their craft on live TV.
Wow. So, thrown right in. That early experience must have set them up for, well, arguably one of their most demanding phases next, working with Todd Rundgren in the early 70s.
Oh, definitely. If you want to see how a young drummer develops serious chops, you look here.
Uh-huh.
This is where Hunt really shows his command of, you know, tricky time signatures, complex arrangements. The Sales brothers played on Rundgren's really important early solo stuff.
Like Runt.
Yep.
Runt in 70, then Runt. The Ballad of Todd Rundgren in 71,
mm-hmm.
and they also contributed to the big one, Something Anything, in 72.
Okay, so that's demanding music. Lots of precision needed, right? Shifting meters, dynamics, not just straight rock beats.
Not at all.
Ah.
Far from it, which, you know, makes that whole Utopia story even more interesting.
Yeah. Yes, Utopia Mark I, 1973. Hunt and Tony Sales, Todd Rundgren. Sounds like a prog rock supergroup in the making.
It did, but it was... incredibly short-lived, the whole tour. Just 2 weeks, then canceled.
2 weeks? Why? What happened?
Well, the sources kind of politely say technological issues.
Hmm. Sounds like code for something else, maybe. Creative differences. Implosion.
Could be. I mean, prog back then, complex music, sometimes complex personalities too, right? Maybe the pressure cooker environment was just too much too soon.
Yeah, maybe.
But the interesting thing is that quick end to Utopia seems to have kind of freed them up, allowed them to pivot towards something... maybe simpler, harder hitting.
Okay, so leaving the prog complexity behind. For a bit, yeah. And that leads pretty directly into their next phase, exploring more straightforward hard rock.
Which brings us to 1976. And this short-lived band called Paris, a power trio, and I mean power, some serious names involved.
Absolutely serious. You had Bob Welch on guitar, you know, formerly of Fleetwood Mac.
Right.
And Glenn Cornick on bass, ex-Jethro Tull. So Hunt Sales is going from Rundgren's intricate stuff to this much heavier, bluesier rock sound. He playing drums, sang backing vocals on their second album, Big Town 2061.
Okay, so he's mastered complex prog. He can hang with these hard rock veterans. And now here it comes. This is the gear shift, I think, that really cements his legacy for a whole generation. Mm-hmm. Moving from Bob Welch to Iggy Pop in 1977, that's a huge jump stylistically.
Oh, it's the pivotal moment, definitely. And it required a completely different drumming approach.
How so?
Well, Iggy demanded, you know, raw energy, aggression, primal power. And the Sales brothers became the rhythm section for Lust for Life.
The album Lust for Life, just a cornerstone. I mean, listen to that title track, that drum beat. It's relentless, driving, simple but perfect.
What made Hunt the right guy for that specific kind of, let's say, controlled chaos?
I think it's that combination. He had the discipline from working with Rundgren, right? But he could apply it with this necessary looseness, this raw force that proto-punk needed.
Right.
It's powerful drumming, yeah, but it's also incredibly tight. It never feels sloppy, never drags, just pushes. And that mix of power and precision, very rare. Especially when you remember who else was deeply involved in those sessions.
David Bowie.
Exactly, David Bowie.
And that connection is just crucial, isn't it? The sources are really clear on this. Bowie remembered how good the Sales Brothers were on Lust for Life. Their dynamic, their professionalism, that power. And that's why he called them, like, over a decade later to join Tin Machine in the late 80s.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Bowie's a decade on. He's done the whole massive 80s pop star thing.
It's dance, yeah. Right, and he needs a reset. He needs a specific kind of energy to shed that glossy image. He wants something raw.
So when Bowie decides, okay, I need to make raw, guitar-heavy, kind of confrontational music again, who does he think of?
The rhythm section that gave Iggy Pop that unforgettable groove, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, it does.
The Sales Brothers brought that that unvarnished primal energy that Bowie needed to sound, well, dangerous again.
And Tin Machine became Hunt's main gig for several years then.
Yep. You've got the first Tin Machine album in 89, then Tin Machine the second in 91, and that live album, Oy Vey, Baby, in 92.
It really shows his adaptability again, moving from Iggy's raw feel to Bowie's more, because angular art rock kind of structures.
Totally different demands, but he handled both.
And while all this Tin Machine stuff is happening, the sources show something else important about his career. He wasn't just the drummer, he was diversifying, using his full musical skill set.
Yeah, this is key for understanding how someone builds a long career, isn't it? He wasn't just sitting behind the kit. He started popping up in movies and TV, sometimes as an actor, sometimes behind the scenes.
Like, he was actually in the movie The Linguini Incident in 91.
Yeah, playing a drummer. And it starred Bowie and Iman, so that connection continued. He was also in an episode of Tales from the Crypt back in 1990.
Okay, so he's comfortable on camera, but you mentioned behind the scenes, too.
Right, and this really shows his depth. He was writing and producing music for soundtracks, not just playing on them.
Oh, interesting. Like what?
Well, for instance, he wrote a song called Stateside for that horror movie Dr. Giggles in 92.
Dr. Giggles, okay.
Yeah, and he wrote Now That You're Gone for Tapeheads in 88. And even produced a track called Tell About Mary for, get this, American Ninja 2, The Confrontation in 1987.
American Ninja 2. Wow. Okay, that's unexpected.
It really demonstrates that his musical knowledge was broad. He understood composition, arranging, production, the whole package. It let him move between being the engine in a rock band and, you know, crafting music for film.
That diversification must be why his career kept going strong. It ensures resilience, opens up different ways to work.
Absolutely. And that versatility kind of explains the next chapter, too. After Tin Machine and all this session and production work, the sources point to a big move in the 2000s.
Where'd he go?
He relocated to Austin, Texas, which, you know, is a real hub for musicians doing production and session work across all sorts of genres.
Austin. Makes sense. A different kind of music scene. More community focused, maybe?
Yeah, very collaborative. And a great example of that Austin period is his work with Lost Super 7.
Oh, that musical collective?
Mm-hmm. He was part of Charlie Sexton's band on their 2005 album, Heard It on the X. It just shows, you know, even after playing with these global icons, he's still grounded in making music within a community.
It connects back to that foundational skill idea, doesn't it? You can go from the huge stage with Bowie back to the respected Austin session scene, and your value, your musicality, is still totally recognized.
It's the proof, really.
And this all kind of leads up to him finally stepping into the spotlight himself, right?
Yeah, much later in his career. That would be his 2019 solo album, Get Your Shit Together. He released it under the name Hunt Sales Memorial.
Get Your Shit Together, great title.
Isn't it? And it feels like a fitting way to sort of cap off this journey we've been tracing, finally showcasing his own voice after decades powering these incredible but very different visions of others.
Well, let's try and wrap this up. What's the big picture here?
Yeah.
We followed this guy from being, you know, Soupy Sales' son and a 60s teen idol through mastering 70s prog with Todd Rundgren, then defining that raw energy for Iggy Pop.
Which was absolutely crucial. His impact on an album like Lust for Life, you can't overstate it.
And then, a decade later, Bowie specifically picks him and his brother to anchor Tin Machine's artistic reset.
It boils down to that foundational skill set, I think. That ability to be incredibly disciplined when needed, but also dynamic and explosive, tight yet powerful, that allowed him to just slide between genres that, on paper, look totally incompatible.
It really raises a fascinating point, especially for musicians listening today. You mentioned Bowie calling the Sales Brothers based on sessions from a decade earlier.
Yeah, the Lust for Life sessions.
Right. So think about this. How does the high-quality work you do now, maybe even on a session gig that feels short-term, create opportunities that might not even show up for years, maybe even a decade down the line?
That decade gap is the ultimate proof of professional reputation, isn't it? The skills you hone today, the impression you make in the studio, that's what someone like Bowie remembers when they need a specific, reliable, foundational talent years later.
It really underlines the lasting value of genuine skill and adaptability, way beyond just chasing the latest trend. Definitely something for you to think about, perhaps while you go track down some of Huntsales' incredibly eclectic work.